Well, hey there. This is Deb's the Horoscopes Lady, and it's March 28, 2007, and this is BBS Radio. This is the show that asks, do you know where your planets are? Tropical astrology is the astrology of the seasons. First day of Aries is the first day of spring, and so on and so on. However, sidereal astrology, we actually look at the constellations, see where those planets are against the background. Today's guest is James Braha. And I'm very excited to have him, actually. I'm going to just do a couple more little rundowns here, and then we'll get to our guest. I want to remind everybody that I will be on the Donna Sebo Show right here on BBS Radio on April 10th. Please listen into that. Donna is a wonderful, wonderful person, and I'm sure a lot of you already listened to her show. And then right now, where are our planets right now for today? The Sun is actually at 13 degrees of Pisces. Venus is at 19 Aries. The moon is in Cancer, right next to Saturn, actually, and this evening, if anywhere in the United States, shortly after sunset, if you go out and look up, you'll be able to see the planet Saturn with your bare eye right next to the moon. It'll look quite pretty. Let me see. Jupiter is in Scorpio. Pluto is in 5 degrees of Sagittarius, not way off the end. Neptune is in 27 Capricorn. Mars is 29 Capricorn. Mercury is 16 Aquarius, and Uranus is 16 Aquarius. And if none of this makes sense to you, stay on the line, and we hope it will shortly. Now I'd like to introduce my guest, James Braha, who, you are so modest, you say that you're one of the people that brought the East to the West, brought ancient Hindu astrology to the United States, but I think you were the first, or at least the first American. What do you have to say about that?
You know, that's really a funny proposition because, you know, there are lots of people who have come to America, you know, using the Vedic or the Hindu system. You know, I was basically the first to write a book on Hindu astrology that was understandable. There was a book even before mine, which was written by Robert Deluce, which was wonderful with calculations, but it didn't help astrologers learn really how to use the system very well. But that was back in I was there in India in 83 and 84, and the book came out around 1986, and it was so, it made the Hindu system so accessible to astrologers that, you know, then all the hidden people that were doing Hindu astrology, even before the book was there, you know, there were people out there. David Frawley, I think, and Hart Defoe, and Chakrapani Ullal, they were using Hindu astrology long before I came on the scene. But my book, and which is interesting because when I wrote my book, I sent it to three publishers, and they all said, no, we cannot sell a book on Hindu astrology. They don't sell. And they didn't sell only because the books that were on the market were written by Indians, and they just weren't understandable. But yeah, the movement's become very big. You know, a lot of people practicing Hindu, or, you know, some call it Hindu astrology, some call it Vedic. It's just a personal preference. And they're using that, you know, a lot of people are finding that the sidereal positions work very well.
That's what I do, you know, so yes.
But what I actually found is that I actually use both systems. I use the Western system, Western tropical astrology system, and I use the Hindu or Vedic sidereal system, but I use them a little differently. I use the Hindu or Vedic system to make more accurate predictions, but the Western system is certainly a very usable system, even for making predictions. But it's, I would say, the tropical system is better for analyzing a personality. Now, that's a personal preference. There are astrologers who think that only one zodiac can exist. To me, that sounds funny because a zodiac is something that is, you know, constructed by human beings to begin with. So there's different ways of viewing it. But, for example, if I look at a Hindu horoscope and I see that there will be great problems with the person's mother. I can see that through the fourth house of the sidereal Hindu system. But I usually won't get a lot of details about what the problems are. I will just know that there are severe problems. Then if I go into the Western system, you know, where we're using Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto also, which I don't really use in the Hindu system, More details tend to be sketched out about the person's experience, particularly, like, for example, I grew up in a family of three boys, and we had a very, very dysfunctional, difficult mother. And that shows up in the Hindu system of all three children, that the mother would be a problem. But if you look at the middle brother's Western horoscope, suddenly the planets are in different signs and they're in different houses. And that middle brother actually had a very good experience of his childhood and his mother, which you could see from the Western tropical positions, whereas the actual more objective criteria, like if somebody objectively came in and, you know, saw, did this guy have a good experience of his home? I mean, were the conditions of the home and the mother very good? Anybody from the outside would say, well, this is terrible. The mother's crazy. You know, this guy's having a bad experience. But actually, his experience was a good experience. And I remember when we grew up, my oldest brother, we were between the age of 20 and 28, the three of us, and we happened to meet in New York. And one day, the oldest brother said to me, gosh, where the hell was Charlie? It's like he grew up in Disney World.
Yeah, a different household.
That was because his experience was quite different from the objective elements. So I see it as both systems can be used, but they sort of get to different, one is more accurate in terms of what actually happens, and the other is a little bit more about the person's experience. At least that's the way I see it. And of course, there are people that will argue that. I used to have arguments with Rick Hauck all the time.
That's what you said, yes. And I talked to James earlier today, and I was saying, I don't think Rick ever forgave me for not going completely Vedic. You know, I stopped at Western Sidereal, and every time I saw him, it's like, but what about this? And I'm like, oh, please, you know, could we just stop fussing about it? He was a sweetie, though. He was an absolute sweetie. How did you get, you said you were in India. Were you in India looking for astrology, or were you in India looking for spiritual development? Were you sightseeing? What were you doing in India in the first place?
Well, I'm going to move outside here because I'm getting I'm having difficulty to hear you. Maybe I'll get a better reception out here. I was at the crossroads of my life. My father had died. I was pretty depressed. I wasn't, you know, doing very much at the time. I was around the age of 28 or 29, and I just decided, you know, if there were ever a time to go to India, which I had always wanted to do, now would be the time. And so I took off, and I had learned a little bit of Western astrology, and I was interested in the Hindu system, but every time I went to read the books on Hindu astrology, they were pretty useless. So what I did was I brought horoscopes of about 30 of my friends and relatives and people that I knew, and I had their Western horoscope. And at that time, I was very consumed with astrology, the Western tropical system, but I really didn't feel like I could do it as a career because I knew that something was missing in the predictive elements. I could see that to me it was more psychological and it was not accurate enough with events. I didn't really believe that I would be able to learn Hindu astrology because every time I picked up a book on the subject, it was just, you couldn't understand it. Particularly, their writings tend to exaggerate. Like, for example, you would pick up an Indian book on Hindu astrology, and it would say something like, if Saturn is in the third house, the person will have lost his fingers or one of his hands will be chopped off or something. If Saturn is in the fifth house, the person will have lost his reason. Now, as a Western astrologer, you read these and you say, well, I know this person has Saturn in the fifth house and he hasn't lost his mind. This person has Saturn in the third house and hasn't lost his fingers. What you eventually find out is that a lot of those authors tend to exaggerate. And when you learn the system, you find out that the fifth house is the mind. Saturn is a planet that causes problems. So if there's Saturn's in the fifth house, the person has depression or they tend to think very heavily or very seriously. The third house is your hands. So if you have Saturn or Mars in the third house, you might be left-handed, or you might have some problems with your hands, or you might work very hard, things like that. So I eventually found that out, that's why the books were so bad, because they were exaggerating everything. So, but when I was there, the very first astrology reading, not a full reading, but, it was the very first time I met someone, he looked at it and he said, "Oh, you have had a divorce." And I said, "Yeah, that's true. And he started telling me a little bit about that. That wasn't a full reading. It was just somebody who knew some astrology. The next time I went to someone, it was actually a paid reading. And he said, very, very interesting things. I was about, 29 or 30 or something like that, 31 at the time.
Let me just interject. That's a classic Saturn return.
It was definitely, I was definitely in the Saturn return, no question about it. But he looked at the chart and he said, you're going to write some books. And I said, "What?" And he said, "You're going to write some books." And I thought he was crazy. I had never done well in English class. I didn't do well in school. But I had been an actor, and having been an actor, I had, I didn't realize it, but I had evidently learned the art of language. But when he said it, I just thought he was crazy. And he said, "No, you'll definitely write some books." And as the years went by, by now, of course, I'm 55 years old. I've written 6 books. But the first one came, at the age of, 33 or 34 or something, and that was the book on ancient Hindu astrology. That was accurate. Another thing he said to me, this I find really interesting now. He said, "You'll be like a research student, and after you have gone very, very deeply in a subject, as deep as you can go, you'll just walk away from it." And I thought, now that was very interesting because... that was funny because I'm not doing astrology anymore.
Right, that's what I was just saying. It's just I found out, as of 2 years ago, that's it. You just kind of walked away.
Right, and then when I actually, that was just an astrological reading, but there was a point about a month later when I found a teacher, okay, and I studied the system. Then I came back here and I used it for a little bit. And then I went back to India again. And my new teacher, the second teacher, he had said to me, the ruler of the 12th house aspects your career house, your 10th house, you're going to have many different careers. No, he said, you have had many careers. I was an astrologer then. I was 33 years old or something. And I had been an actor. I had been a teacher of meditation. And I had been in business. But I thought, yes, I've had other careers. And he looked at me and he said, "And you'll have more careers after this one." And I thought, my God, because I was pretty firmly entrenched in astrology at that point. I hadn't written a book, but I was pretty dedicated. And then 22 years after, being an astrologer, the point came where I got into non-duality of, enlightenment, spiritual subjects. I had always been into those subjects, but I had never, actually gotten to the end of it and wanted to teach it. But that happened about 2.5 years ago, and I had done thousands of horoscopes, and it was pretty much played out, for me. I had done as much as I wanted to do with it.
Okay. How did that, I just wanted to know astrologically, what was he looking at? Was he looking at the dashas?
For which prediction?
Well, for the prediction that, to me, it's more fascinating that, you're going to be doing this, and then, boom, you're going to stop and go do something else.
There were two different things. Actually, the man who said I would be like a research student was looking at my Jupiter opposite Saturn. And that particular placement in my horoscope occurs within minutes, not even degrees. It's an exact Jupiter-Saturn opposition. And he said, "You'll be like a research student. You'll go very deeply. And then when you're done, you'll walk away." So now they're also very intuitive in India. So you never know to what extent, they're saying something. Sometimes it'll be astrological, sometimes it'll be intuitive. They are very, very intuitive over there, the astrologers. The other prediction was because that you would have many different careers was because the 12th house is a very bad house in the Hindu system. So is the 8th house. The 8th house and the 12th house and the 6th house are called dushtanas, or grief-producing houses. So when the ruler of the 12th house aspected, you know, it throws a natal aspect
right.
onto my career house, he said, you're going to have different careers. And I would see that when I was practicing, I would see it all the time. And I could save, I would save people an awful lot of trouble. I would say, let me tell you right now that if you are looking for one career, you'll be frustrated pretty much your whole life, because you'll never, even within a career, you'll never be completely satisfied that you have found the proper career, because that 12th house element on the career will cause questions, confusions, problems, things like that.
Okay.
And that's a pretty, is a pretty common aspect.
Let me go back and ask you, you had said something about when you were reading the first books, and I had not read any of those books before I read, I think the first one of yours I read actually was How to Be a Great Astrologer, and then I read Ancient Hindu Astrology for the Modern Western Astrologer after that. I always, and but then I went back, you know, and I read other Hindu texts, and I assumed, you know, and I didn't think of them so much as exaggerating, but I thought because life was so tough in the culture that they were writing the astrological predictions, they were writing the astrological meanings, I guess, in the text, that these types of things would play out more, like you would lose your fingers or, you know, someone would lose their mind or whatever examples you gave.
I appreciate what you're saying, but the problem is these are being written by modern writers.
Ah, okay. So there you
even
go.
Let me say another thing. I mean, this gets a little complex, but it's also quite
interesting. No, that's okay. Because I want to you know, hear what you have to say about this.
Sure. But I'm about to say something fun, something kind of weird. So that's why I prefaced it. But I have to say this, that in India, at least up until the 80s, you know, now there might be more money in India, but in India, up until a certain point of time, they were very poor, and being very poor, nobody really would come across much money. So the one thing that people could gain was status, okay? They could gain some professional status. They couldn't really get much money. So when it comes to astrology, many of the astrologers, well, really almost all of them, are very, very guarded about teaching what they know. So they would write books. And they would write books because they wanted to be famous, but they wouldn't really want to tell you their secrets. When I was there, it was very, very interesting, because both times, both teachers that I was with, they were willing to tell me everything that they knew, because they knew I was going back to America. It's just like an actor. You would never see Woody Allen and all these actors doing commercials over here. It would be terrible for their career. But they will do commercials for Japan and China. They don't care about that, because nobody's going to see it. So that's part of why the books were so poorly written, as far as I can tell.
Okay, all right. Yeah. I want to ask you, that's funny, but you know, I wanted to know your insight. You know, what was there? Good deal. I wanted to ask you one thing. I got into a little bit of trouble in a lecture I gave a couple years ago, and then I wrote a book called Gift Giving by the Stars, and I talked a little bit in there about, you know, birthstones. And in America, in the United States, or the Western world, you know, the emerald's supposed to be for May, and God, I can't remember the other ones. But this is, and I said it as much as anything else, this was marketing, good marketing. We got these stones we want to push. Lots of people are born in this month. Let's push the expensive stones in this month. And this gentleman stood up from India, and he was furious. I said, wait. I didn't mean Vedic.
Right.
Okay, James, so let me ask you about that jewelry story again.
That's when it cut out, right?
Yeah, that's when it cut out. I was saying, you know, this gentleman jumped up out of the audience and said, he went crazy. And I'm like, no, I didn't mean to imply, you know. But, of course, now you have a bit of this up on your website. So, you know, talk about how the Vedics or the Hindus use jewelry.
Am I on the air right now?
You are on the air right now. We are back live.
Okay. For how long?
Not too long. I told you only 20 minutes, but I'd love to have you finish up this question.
That's not a problem. I just wanted to know. I once went on the radio, and I thought I was on for an hour, and I found out the guy was going to have me from midnight to 5 a.m.
Anyway, oh, my goodness.
Gemstones are a very, very fundamental feature of the Hindu system. And it's not like Western astrology, which I tend to think, when it comes to gemstones, I tend to think is not very realistic, mainly because even if they had gotten the stones correct, even if they did, it makes no sense, because they would tell you that this particular month, the month of June is this stone and the month of July is that stone.
Exactly.
And astrology doesn't even work month by month. But anyway, in the Hindu system, everything in creation comes under the rulership of some planet. Love and art and beauty and sweets comes under the rule of Venus. Communications and writings and contracts come under the rulership of Mercury. Well, gemstones also come under the rulership of planets, and they are very, very, it's almost like each particular stone is a subtle vibration of the planetary energy. So, for example, I wear a 12-carat yellow sapphire. Now, I'll explain. Normally, we say that the stones should be about 2 or 3 carats. As long as they're high quality, not filled with inclusions and cracks and all that. But if they're high quality, a good 2 or 3 carat stone should serve the purpose. For one thing, there are certain stones there's one stone called the birthstone, and that relates to your ascendant. So if your ascendant is Taurus is ruled by Venus, your birthstone is a diamond. If you can't afford diamond, you get a white sapphire or some other stone that looks like diamond, as long as it's a natural stone. If you're a Gemini or Virgo ascendant, it's ruled by Mercury. The stone for Mercury is a green emerald. A secondary stone would be a green tourmaline. And those are your birthstones. Those are more important than anything else, because the ascendant is going to rule your life the whole lifetime. Secondly, when you come to a planetary period, we have dashas or planetary periods. Saturn is always a 19-year period. Mercury is 17 years. The Sun is 6 years. So if you come to a dasha, a period of the Sun, you should wear the red ruby for those 6 years. When the period ends, generally you take the stone off. Sometimes you can leave them on, but if it's the stone of a malefic like Saturn, Mars, or Sun, you take it off when it's over. But the reason I wear such a large yellow sapphire is around 1997, I came to a period of Jupiter. Now, Jupiter in my horoscope is opposite Saturn to the degree, and it's aspected by Mars to the degree. The aspect from Mars in the Western system is called a quincunx, or sometimes they call it an inconjunct.
Inconjunct,
which, yeah. Well, inconjunct really means no aspect at all. It's a crazy term. The real proper term is quincunx. But anyway, the only quincunx that is an aspect in the Hindu system comes from Mars. If you have a 150-degree aspect from Jupiter, Saturn, Mercury, Sun, Venus, it doesn't mean anything.
It means nothing.
But Mars always aspects the eighth house from itself, and that's a 150-degree aspect. So my Jupiter is aspected to the degree by Mars and Saturn, and that means that Jupiter, the Jupiter dasha, which lasts 16 years, is potentially a rough dasha. Now, in my case, Jupiter rules the eighth house, which is longevity. And when I saw my second teacher, after I had learned the system, I realized the Jupiter dasha, the Jupiter period, and Saturn sub-period could kill me. So you have Jupiter, then Jupiter-Saturn, then Jupiter-Mercury, then Jupiter-Ketu, then Jupiter-Venus. Within the 16 years of Jupiter, you have the sub-periods of all the other planets. Since Jupiter rules the eighth house, and since Saturn is a major malefic, I knew that aspect could end my life. And way back when I was 30 or 33, I asked the astrologer, will that period kill me? And he said, not definitely. In other words, maybe yes, maybe yes. And then he gave me the explanation why it might not kill me. But I always remembered, I knew that what Jupiter was doing in the horoscope. So right before the period, I went out and got the largest and highest quality yellow sapphire that I could get. Now, in India, when you try out a gemstone, the way to do it is to tape the stone to your finger or tape the stone to your body and keep it there for a day or two. And watch how you feel in those few days and watch the news that comes to you. And that's what lets you know whether that stone is really good. Well, as soon as I put the stone on, right away, within those few days, I started getting tremendous intuition, much more than normal. And Jupiter rules the eighth house, which is intuition, so it made sense. And then Jupiter also rules the 11th house, which is major desires. And one of my major desires that had been around for about 10 or 15 years by the time that dasha began was I had always wanted my book, Ancient Hindu Astrology, to be published in German. Not because I thought it would make a lot of money, but just because I thought, you know, the German culture, they're very precise. Everything has to be precision. And I said, the Germans would love Hindu astrology. And for about 5 years, after the book came out, I used to mail that book to German publishers. And 3 or 4 months later, they'd say, thanks, but no thanks. We're not interested.
Right.
after about 5 years, I stopped sending the book out. When I put on that yellow sapphire, within 2 days, within the time that the stone was on me, I got a phone call, it was a phone call, and they said, we want to publish your Hindu astrology book in German. And I thought, well, I'm definitely going to get this gemstone because it's obviously working. And, gemstones are not like going to, like, for example, John Lennon should have had a yellow sapphire in the period that killed him. I don't know that the stone would have stopped him from getting killed. It would definitely help. You know, the stones don't completely get rid of the bad karma, but they certainly help a great deal.
That's fascinating. Which books of your books would you recommend for someone who's never picked up an astrology book before, never picked up a Hindu astrology book? And I know you've got a new one that has nothing to do with astrology, and I do want to hear, and that'll be my last question. I want to hear about what you're doing now.
Okay. If they know nothing of astrology, then I would say get my autobiographical book called Astrologos, Revelations of a Hindu Astrologer. And they can go to my website, jamesbraha.com, and they'll see all the books and, you know, they'll see what they're about. But that's the one for somebody who doesn't know anything. It's a fascinating story of going to India and learning about Hindu astrology, and it's also got Western astrology in there as well. So that's fascinating. That's where I would start.
Okay, if someone knows a little bit of astrology, which one would you recommend?
Then I would go straight to the Ancient Hindu Astrology for the Modern Western Astrologer.
Yeah, I still thumb through that. I love it.
Some libraries carry that book.
I've heard that, but I'd just soon you sell the book, okay? What are you doing now? Just tell me what's your book. You've got a new book out, and you've gone in a different direction, and that'll be my last question for you.
Okay. Well, there's two things I'm doing. One is I'm making money. I lived as an astrologer for 22 years, and I was always in debt. And now one of the things I'm doing is investing in silver and gold companies, gold and silver stocks. I've been doing that for 5 years, and I pay my bills through that. And it's nice to have money after a lifetime of hard work and service. Other than that, I had been pursuing enlightenment, higher consciousness, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, since the age of 20. And before I became an astrologer, I was teaching meditation, transcendental meditation, pursuing enlightenment. And then I got into astrology, and I was still meditating, still pursuing enlightenment. And, you know, all day long in the back of my mind was, someday you'll be in some great state of consciousness, maybe in another lifetime, you know, and someday the psychological suffering that we all live with will stop. And that was really, I would wake up with that and I'd go to sleep with that. It was on the back of my mind. It was behind everything I did. And I would do all kinds of different, you know, spiritual techniques and workshops and psychological this and diets, anything you could do. And nothing, you know, for 30 years I got better and better. I got better and better. And yet, psychological suffering was still there as much as ever in a certain respect. Like a lot of the neurotic behavior had gone, but there was still a fear of death. There was still a feeling of being separate from everything. There was still, you know, when I would wake up in the middle of the night, you know, to go to the bathroom, my thoughts in the middle of the night would be, let's see, what do I have to worry about? What sort of things are, do I have to make sure don't happen? You know, like that, like always waiting for a shoe to drop, you know? And, well, I mean, basically we're all waiting for a crash landing. We're all going to die, you know? So anyway, I had picked up a book. I started reading some books on what's called Advaita, or non-duality. Advaita means not to. It means basically that even though we live in a world of appearance where there's all kinds of different people and different things, it's all underlined by oneness, by consciousness. In other words, if a scientist begins to analyze anything in the physical universe, it all gets boiled down to energy or light. And that energy or light is the oneness that pervades everything. And everything in the physical universe is changing. And so it's not real. It keeps changing. So I picked up a book called What's Wrong With Right Now, Unless You Think About It, by an Australian teacher of non-duality. I read the book and I was blown away by how, I was just blown away by it. It presented the case for non-duality very, very well. So I immediately knew that I wanted to, you know, speak to that man. I called him up on the phone and I invited him to come to America and stay at my house and give lectures. And he was about 75 at the time. He had quit touring probably 10 years earlier, but he said that his wife needed a vacation. She hadn't had a vacation in years. And I told him, we live near the water. I'd pay his plane fare. I'd pay his way. If they wanted to come, we'd love to have him. And I sent him a copy of my autobiographical book so he knew who I was. He agreed to come. He came here. And after 30 years of seeking, I finally got it. I'm not talking about some gigantically mystical state of consciousness. I'm just talking about the simple awareness of my real nature, which is not dualistic. Basically, who we are is awareness. In other words, and to make it simple, if I go to look for James, all I can find are things that change. I find a physical body that's here, and you know, 50 years from now, it's not going to be here. It's going to disintegrate. I look to find a James. I find, other than the physical body, I find thoughts and feelings. Well, my thoughts and feelings, they keep changing as well. What I'm looking for, when you're looking for enlightenment, you're looking for your real, true nature. So when you look to find something that's real and true, you're looking to find something that is lasting, that has always been and will always be. And what you find, if you look to find a self, is all these things that change, the feelings, the thoughts, and the body, but the one thing that has never changed is the awareness. The awareness that allows you to be aware of life, the awareness that allows you to be aware of the body, the awareness that allows you to be aware of the thoughts and feelings has always been and will always be. And once that is realized, then the psychological sufferings in life dissipate because you know that they're just not real. You know that the things that are happening are coming and going, and the real James, the real me, is the awareness, which was here before the body was born and will be here after the body dies, and that is who we are. So I wrote a book on that whole experience with Sailor Bob, for the five-week experience, and that's called Living Reality. Living Reality. My Extraordinary Summer with Sailor Bob.
Well, I think that'll be the next book I read, and I'm sincere about that. I had mentioned when I talked to you earlier, you're one of the most sincere people I've ever met, and, you know, it's just a pleasure. That in itself is a pleasure, just to have a conversation with you.
Well, I appreciate
that. Thank you. It's true. No, thank you so much for taking your time today.
Oh, okay,
that was James Braha. Okay, good. Thank you. That was James Braha, everybody. All right, let's get back to, I had mentioned last week on the weekly horoscopes on mybirthchart.com about Tony Blair being in the news for the next 6 weeks, and that he would be very much, you know, out and about there. And the question was, would he be able to hold on to his prime ministership, I guess, the prime minister's position this summer when Saturn changed houses and changed signs and went into a different house, and he would be moving his fourth house. So there you go. I put that up there on Friday, and next thing you know, of course, they've taken British sailors out of the water, and he is going to be very much in the news. I want everyone to pay attention. Now, you don't have to be Tony Blair, obviously. You don't have to be a world leader. But I want everyone to pay attention, starting literally in another day's time. Mars will be transiting and going into the constellation of Aquarius. You might remember the guest last week who said that she switched. She went from tropical to sidereal, not so much on the personality stuff, because she kind of liked her personality in tropical, but on the predictive end, which is what James had just said. That's what he uses the sidereal zodiac, Hindu specifically, for. Everyone will feel a shift in energy. So, pencils in hand. And you don't have to know what your horoscope is. Just pay attention to how your life changes in the next week, and it'll stay that way for 6 weeks, where the focus of the energy is. And just see where in these next 12 areas I'm going to give you that it's shifting. Okay, if Mars is shifting into your first house, you will, boy, it's like an internal spring. You will, women are so funny because they'll go out and color their hair different colors, or get new fingernail polish, buy clothes. You know, men will do the same sort of thing. Well, not, maybe not the fingernail polish stuff. They'll buy new cars, faster cars, and it's all about appearance. People will get new business cards. It's all about appearance. If, however, over the next 6 weeks you think you either get a raise or something, more income coming in, or opportunity for more income coming in, or you think, gee, maybe I ought to look at how I spend my money, where it's being spent, and you're looking at insurance, you know, saving money that way, then Mars has probably moved into your second house. If all of a sudden you get a phone call out of the blue from your siblings, which could not necessarily be a good thing, or it could be a very happy thing, depending on your family background. If you get calls from your siblings or other close family members, cousins, people like that, people in the neighborhood want you to do stuff, Mars has probably transited your third house. If, however, you get a real nesting instinct, I've got to do stuff for my house. Now, in combination with other things, this could actually mean you can move into a new place that you've already purchased. But this is probably more, okay, I'm buying furniture for the house or pillows, or I'm getting rid of the stuff I'm having, clearing it out, I'm doing something for my home. If, however, now this also has to do with your home, but it's more of a social aspect of, okay, I've got all these new plates and dishes. I want to invite people over, or I feel like going out to dinner, I feel more artistic, I'm putting up things that make my house look pretty, then Mars has moved into your fifth house. Also, if your siblings drop off your nieces and nephews, or your grandchildren, as the case may be, and you spend a lot of time with them in the next 6 weeks, Mars could certainly be moving through your fifth house. If Mars in Aquarius is moving through your sixth house, and again, all this is sidereal. If it's moving through your sixth house, this gets overlooked by a lot of astrologers. I'm just coming out of this, and actually, I kind of like it a lot. It is a time where you get to look at your health and diet, and no, that does not mean you've got to lose 5 pounds. It's like, gee, am I drinking enough water? Maybe I'll change things up. You know, I need more fats in my diet, good fats, of course, or I need more fruit in my diet. It's also a time to look at your workday schedule, and this is what I really love it for. I get to organize, and anyone with Mars going through the sixth house, they get to organize their workday exactly the way they want it. Do they want to start early? Do they want to start late? How long do they want to work on a certain thing, then take their break? If they need new office furniture or to move things around, this is the time to do it. If Mars is transiting your seventh house, And again, everybody notice, you know, these changes, because they will be happening just like clockwork, starting in a day and going for the next 6 weeks. If Mars is going into your seventh house, be transiting your seventh house in Aquarius, you will meet new people. You can't help it. They'll just come at you. Now, if some of you just started a job last Monday and you've met new people, okay, that's good. But you're going to be, and that would be the sixth house, you know, changing your career. Now the people that you meet stay in your life. They're interesting. They're people that excite you. They're people that, you know, help you out. It's like a new society. You go out and you find new restaurants with them. It's a lot of fun. People always say that's romance, but it's more, it's friendship. You know, it's finding people that you jive with. If Mars goes into your eighth house in another day and stays there for 6 weeks, dollars to donuts, I will bet anyone, you will start having really weird dreams. It'll start with dreams. And what it is, it's all the skeletons in your closet. It's all those things, like James was saying, that, you know, he used to have fears about. You know, wake up in the middle of the night and just, you know, stuff would bug you. They bug you. If you're afraid that you're not doing a good job, if you're afraid you won't get the loan, if you're afraid, you know, your kids are going wrong or something, all those fears come up. And what I tell people is, don't get stuck on the fear aspect. Get stuck on, well, don't get stuck on it, but look at what exactly is scaring you and what's realistic about this, and can you do something about it, or, you know, is something left over you can get rid of. When Mars transits your ninth house, you start traveling. Some people start teaching, some people start taking new classes, but everyone starts traveling. And what they're traveling to do is to find the oracle. And you know what? You don't have to get on a plane for that. A lot of people do, particularly in this society. They start, they'll take a class, or their company ships them somewhere, so they got to like travel, you know, many more miles a day. But sometimes it's traveling to a new neighborhood right around the corner, and all of a sudden you find a world that you've never seen before, and it opens up something inside of you. It's a marvelous time. It's a very happy time, actually. It's a time where you get to meet people. Again, it's reminiscent of the seventh house. You get to meet people that do something, cheer you up, bring your mind up. It's a good time. When Mars goes transit your 10th house, and my guest was talking about that last week, career-wise, you really take off, or status-wise, you know, for people that don't have jobs, but they do have status in the neighborhood. And the good news is everybody watches and sees what you're doing. The bad news is everybody watches and sees what you're doing. So if you go out the door and you're thinking, oh, I'm just running to the grocery store, it doesn't matter that my hair's a mess, I'm wearing sweat clothes, and I've got a hole in my tennis shoe, I guarantee you everybody will see you like that, and they'll remember it. So if all of a sudden you get a chance to start doing something in your career or that improves your status being out in the public, then Mars is transiting your 10th house. It's going to be there for 6 weeks. And, you know, clean up before you go out the door. Do yourself a favor. You know, brush your teeth, brush your hair. If Mars is going into your 11th house for the next 6 weeks, what will have happened is that whatever you did the previous 6 weeks, this past 6 weeks I'm talking about, you will get rewarded for it, or you will pay the consequences of it. It's so much better when you get rewarded for it. A lot of people get their reviews for raises when Mars is transiting the 10th house, or they get promoted, but they actually start getting the money for it, you know, the real rewards, when Mars is transiting the 11th house. It's also when your friends and neighbors might, you know, just say thank you, throw you a party. You might end up in the newspaper for doing a good job somewhere. So it's kind of a nice thing, you know, and say thank you. Always say thank you. When Mars is transiting people's 12th house, and again, it'll be 6 weeks, what inevitably happens is they don't even want to hear the telephone ring, which to me would be a delight today. You know, you can turn your cell phone off. They don't want to be disturbed. They want and they desperately need to take a mental rest. This is very important. They can read brain candy. They can just turn off all the noise and sit out back in the afternoon or early evening and just be quiet. You really, really, really need to rest your body and your mind. Very important. Rest your mind before Mars goes back into your first house. Now, this entire cycle takes 2.5 years. And that's why when people think back, it's funny because James just said to me, on the phone, you know, about 2.5 years ago, he stopped doing this. You know, he started I don't know. I don't have his chart in front of me, so I don't know where Mars was. But I would look at that and say, okay, you started a new Mars cycle. Because every 2.5 years, it's about that long, people will look back and say, oh, yeah, I did that. Oh, yeah, I moved to the next level. Oh, yeah, I got promoted. Or, oh, yeah, I took up that hobby then. It's where you decide where you want to spend your energy, where you use Mars. It is considered Vedically, a malefic, a bad guy. And it can be if you don't know how to handle it. But he's also the guy that says, okay, get up, get moving, make things happen. And so I kind of enjoy him. Of course, he's rather prominent in my chart, so that I kind of have to enjoy him. It's better off. All right, I did mention earlier that tonight, if you look out to the east, you see Saturn rising in the east with the moon. It'll be quite lovely. Both of them are in the constellation Leo. That's where they are. So look around. Saturn and the moon will be like right in between the paws of Leo, where he stretches out his paws. You can see this with backyard telescope. Well, actually, you can see Saturn with your eyes. If you have a backyard telescope, you can see the rings and Saturn's largest moons. What you will not be able to see, and somebody emailed me about this morning. I guess it showed up on Yahoo or something last night. Saturn right now, they wanted to know what the astrological significance of this is. Now, my thought is, if I can't see it, and most of my culture cannot see it, we are not aware of it. We're not conscious of it. The Vedics do not use anything past Saturn because they cannot see it. So how could you possibly be aware of it? However, they're teaching kindergartners about, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. Yes, I still use Pluto as a planet. So we are aware of it culturally. So, yes, I certainly use those outer planets. A little bit different than most tropical astrologers probably, but that's another thing. Okay, so when you go outside, and what you will not be able to see is around Saturn's north pole. It's twice as wide as the Earth. They've got what they call a polar vortex up there. Now, we have the same thing around our poles, but it's circular. If you look at it from up in the sky, it's circular, and that's what you would expect. It's a vertex. It's swirling gases. The one around Saturn is a hexagon shape, which is fascinating. We've never seen anything else like it. And how would these swirling gases form a hexagon? So someone was kind enough to email me and say, well, what does this mean? And I am saying publicly, I did email her back earlier today, I'm saying publicly, I don't have a darn clue. I don't have a darn clue. I don't know if a numerologist can tell you if Saturn has anything to do with six, the number six, which is a hexagon. But I can tell you that it's a lovely phenomenon. I'm not worried about it. I don't think anything, was gone wrong because of it. So that was a long thing to get into about Saturn's polar vertex. But it'll be a pretty sight tonight coming up if you go out in the sky and see it. I do want to remind everybody that there are free weekly sidereal horoscopes every week on mybirthchart.com. I update them every Friday morning. If you are curious to see what your chart looks like in the sidereal system, you can get that for free. Just get the chart for free either on mybirthchart.com or searchbythestars.com. You can go either place and get that for free. If you want to see a little bit more concrete personality-wise, well, what I'm this in tropical, what am I in sidereal, I do what's called a zodiac challenge. My husband did that, such a masculine word, challenge, as opposed to zodiac comparison. At any rate, on mybirthchart.com, and I think that one's $7.50. If you have to buy a gift for anybody that, you're thinking, what do I get this person? This is free. Go to searchbythestars.com and put in someone's birth date on the front page there. On the home page, and you can get gift suggestions for free. If you'd like to buy the book, you can certainly get it there through searchbythestars.com. That's Gift Giving by the Stars. And, of course, Amazon has it, and bookstores, and libraries, too, which, interesting, James had brought that up. All right, and I'm going to finish up today with just letting you know the dates that you were born. And later on, I will make sure I'll get this up on BBS Radio. on my webpage there, so you can go and check that anytime. But for right now, if you were born between April 13th and May 14th, your sun was in Aries. If you were born from May 14th to June 14th, your sun was in Taurus. If you were born from June 16th to July 16th, your sun was in Gemini. If you were born from July 16th to August 16th, your sun was in Cancer. If you were born between August 16th and September 16th, your sun was in Leo. If you were born from September 16th to October 17th, the sun was in Virgo. If you were born from October 17th to November 16th, the sun was in Libra. If you were born from November 16th to December 15th, the sun was in Scorpio. If you were born from December 15th to January 14th, the sun was in Sagittarius. If you were from January 14th to February 12th, the sun was in Capricorn. If you were born from February 12th to March 14th, the sun was in Aquarius. And if you were born from March 14th to April 13th, the sun was in Pisces. And those dates overlap because it depends on the year, and The sun does not care about clocks. It'll just cross over in the middle of the day whenever it feels like it. And if you were completely confused with everything I just said, then turn back in next week to Deb's The Horoscope Lady. It's a sidereal astrology show. Thank you, and bye now.